We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
The dignity of man. Our guest today writes in his new book, the question is not whether the U.S. will lose its unchallenged global power, but just how precipitous and wrenching the decline will be. You may have heard the word entropy. It's a law of thermodynamics. One of its meanings is a process of degradation or running down or a trend to disorder. Since 1941, when the American century was announced with boundless optimism, the United States has been the unquestioned source of power arranging the world. Now, what's often called the American century is showing signs of entropy. How do we know we are nearing the end of our undisputed power? How did we get here? And how frightening is it not to know what's next? After what will undoubtedly be uncomfortable falling apart of things, perhaps it might even be better. Perhaps the good things, the aspects we patriots know and treasure about America, freedom, democracy, and justice, may actually not only survive, but thrive as they have not in a very long time. Oftentimes, as we know, things need to fall apart before they can be reordered into something better. Our guest today writes, America's hegemony, it's visibly crumbling amid a tectonic shift in global power. Over the next hour, we'll talk with Alfred McCoy about his new book, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. Alfred McCoy, thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Bert, a pleasure to be back.
Alfred McCoy is the Harrington Professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a beautiful campus. McCoy has been recognized as, quote, one of the world's leading historians of Southeast Asia and an expert on Philippine political history, opium trafficking in the Golden Triangle, underworld crime syndicates, and international political surveillance. As a PhD candidate in Southeast Asian history at Yale, long time ago, McCoy testified before the U.S. Senate Committee on Appropriations Foreign Operations Subcommittee in 1972 and accused American officials of condoning and even cooperating with corrupt elements in Southeast Asia's illegal drug trade out of political and military considerations. Despite the protestations of by the CIA, his book, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade, was published by Harper and Row, despite their objections. His book, A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror, was published in 2006. Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State came out in 2009. Torture and Impunity, the U.S. Doctrine of Coercive Interrogation, was published in 2012. His new book, again, is In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power, comes out in the fall of 2017. Well, again, thanks for being with us. When I was young, in the 1950s, all of us kids felt tremendous pride in America. We were the country that small nations under the heel of colonial powers looked to as an example. We got out from under the British and enjoyed the amazing gift of self-government, which the rest of the world looked up to. Sure, we believed we faced a threat from the Soviet Union. What was scary about them was their militaristic empire building and the crushing of freedoms under their boot. We had freedom. The people in their empire did not. America was unique in standing clearly really against empire. The peoples in the small nations oppressed by the big militaristic powers looked to us. Everyone knew that unlike other countries, America was about a huge and secure middle class, not the extremely rich or extremely poor as in other places. We elementary school kids were not taught that being a global power was an essential part of our character. Then came Vietnam. What a wake-up call that was. Please tell us about some personal experiences, Alfred McCoy, that shed light on the darker side of America's prosperity and architecture of U.S. global power.
Well, those veterans of World War II and Korea paid a terrible personal price for that great global victory that established the United States as the preeminent power and then checked Soviet expansionism or the expansionism of its client state, North Korea, and maintained the kind of U.S. encirclement of the Eurasian landmass. And the price was paid in the post-traumatic stress disorder, the PTSD, that all those veterans suffered. Back in my childhood, in the 1950s, that perfect time in American life, when, as Life magazine kind of celebrated, it was sort of a long, great national picnic. Mind you, there was seething and change underneath, the civil rights movement, African Americans, but the country was amazingly prosperous, yes. Amazingly united. But beneath that, those veterans, the 15 million veterans, many of them were very seriously psychologically damaged. In my parents' parties back in the 1950s, my father worked at Raytheon Corporation on the 128 complex. Uh-huh. He would drive up to New Hampshire for the alcohol beverage control place. You guys got up there, uh-huh. Load up the trunk of the car, not with beer and wine, but with scotch and vodka. And those veterans would knock back four and five drinks of that stuff. Many of them were on what I call liquid therapy, which was the only therapy the United States had to deal with that. So the ascent of America to world power was paid by a tremendous price by those veterans, and it's now being paid again. Right. But this time, of course, they're not citizen soldiers; they're professionals.
Yeah, true. Well, I had certainly never heard of Halford Mackinder. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Before reading your book, who was he, and what lesson did he teach well ahead of his time about the nature of global hegemony? It has to do with oceans and land, and for example, the nature of Britain's power in the world relative to the causal connections between geography and global power. How has he been proven right? What did he say, and how has he been proven right?
Yeah, Alfred Mackinder, in January of 1904, at the Royal Geographical Society in Savile Row, London, gave a lecture. And how many lectures have there been since that time? Tens of millions?
Yeah.
Most of them pretty inconsequential, most of them utterly boring and immediately forgettable, if in fact everybody manages to stay awake all the way to the end. Mm-hmm. But this was one of those amazing exceptions. And what Halford Mackinder put forward was a geographical perspective on history. And what he propounded was that the arc of history in Europe and indeed the world revolved around the world island. And as a geographer, what he did is he looked at the map and he realized that when you sort of change the perspective, tilt the globe slightly, what you see is in fact three continents that merge into almost a single landmass, Europe and Asia, which are in fact one continent actually, and then Africa. And he said, this is the epicenter of history. There are outlying islands, Greenland, North America, South America, Australia, but they're not the epicenter of history. It's this world island. And the struggle for global dominion, for global power, lies in control of the world island. And he said that, you know, until the 16th century, the landsmen, by that he meant the hordes, Tamerlane, Genghis Khan, that for 400 years came out of Central Asia and pounded in the gates of Vienna and threatened Europe in the 16th century. Now what had happened because of Europe's discovery of the sea route around the world island, around the tip of Africa, and beating through the roaring 40s and all the way to Asia, that they had discovered a way of surrounding the continent geopolitically and dominating it. And he said that this was the great arc of history. Now, not only was this a kind of bold, sweeping historical interpretation, but in that lecture, what Mackinder discovered was the art and science of geopolitics. That's to say, in that single lecture, he envisioned something that inspired world leaders thereafter. Adolf Hitler was a student of Mackinder's indirectly. His Mackinder's acolyte in Germany was a guy named Karl Haushofer, who actually tutored Hitler. Hitler's deputy Führer was his research assistant. He was the head of the German research body under the Nazi regime. His son trained the Nazi diplomatic corps in geopolitics, and he inspired Hitler's concept of Lebensraum, the idea that Germany needed to break through into the pivot region, the center of this Eurasian landmass, to gain Lebensraum, living room, right, for the Germanic people. And that's what inspired, of course, the disastrous German attack on Stalingrad, which cost the Third Reich 800,000 soldiers killed and captured. And in our own time, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was National Security Advisor under President Jimmy Carter, he's a full-throated acolyte of Sir Alfred Mackinder. You read Brzezinski's books, and he's always talking about Mackinder's theory. And he applied this. He had the idea that he would use radical Islam as kind of a wedge or a spear, and he would drive it from Afghanistan through Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, right into the heart of then Soviet Central Asia. And this would have the effect of shearing away Eastern Europe, that with the Soviet forces tied down in Central Asia, thousands of miles to the west, Eastern Europe would break free of the Soviet Empire. And Brzezinski came up with the idea of Operation Cyclone, which was about a $100 million a year operation of mobilizing radical Islam run by the CIA. Of course, it created the jihadists, Osama bin Laden, and all the rest of that. And in the 1990s, he gave an interview to a French magazine. He said, look, what's more important in the history of the world, a few stirred up Muslims or the liberation of Eastern Europe? And for Brzezinski, an emigre Polish aristocrat, clearly it was the liberation of Eastern Europe. So this is something that if you believe Mackinder, you believe his acolytes, Haushofer, Hitler, Brzezinski, and I guess by implication President Carter, this is something that has shaped world history, and I'm arguing that it's shaping our present and future.
Yes. Yes, it does seem to be doing just that. It's fascinating how, you know, one thing I have learned from history is that we never learn from history. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest is Alfred McCoy. Having him back on, it's great to have him on. His new book is In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. Now, I understand that a big part of the reason India won its independence was because formerly Great Britain had spent its treasury, you know, in the Second World War. And they, of course, depended on the seas for their power. I don't know what portion of America's treasury has been spent on growing and maintaining our own empire since the war in the Philippines in 1898 and fighting the Cold War. Wasn't there a rather obvious lesson we failed to learn from the Brits and their massive empire?
In a sense, we're a successor empire. We've tried to take the best from them. In fact, we inherited their geopolitical position, and indeed, arguably improved upon it. As the British pulled out of Southeast Asia, and then their last withdrawal in the 1970s out of the Persian Gulf, we filled in right behind them. Yeah. And as the British maintained 30 naval bastions around the globe, ringing the Eurasian landmass with their navy, so we've done the same. We're very much a successor empire. And to pick up on what we were talking about earlier, Mackinder, the British imperial historian John Darwin at Oxford University has argued in a sweeping survey of 1,000 years of history on that Eurasian landmass that the United States emerged as history's most powerful empire because we're the first empire in 1,000 years that controlled both axial ends of the Eurasian landmass. And we did that at the end of World War II in 1949. We established NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. We had bases in Western Europe. We had Allied armies and forces there. And then we had a series of 4 bilateral agreements in Asia, the other end of the other axial point, the other end of Eurasia. We had those agreements with Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Australia. And the combination of the multilateral NATO pact and then the bilateral pacts along the Pacific littoral, the chain of islands off the coast of Asia, gave us this controlling position. And then we built upon those 2 axial points through a series of bilateral agreements that ran from NATO through Central Asia to CETO, the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, the Australia, New Zealand, U.S. ANZUS agreement, and then those bilateral agreements that I mentioned. And then we created a series of fleets, the 6th Fleet for the Mediterranean and the Atlantic, then the 7th Fleet in the Western Pacific, or actually the whole of the Pacific, but based in the Western Pacific, originally at Subic Bay, now near Tokyo. And then the 5th Fleet in the Persian Gulf after the British pulled out and we took over their old naval base at Bahrain. And then recently, under President Obama, we added another sort of circle of steel on top of the military packs and the naval fleets and then the air bases as well, in drone bases. And the United States now has about 60 drone bases stretching from Sicily in the Mediterranean all the way to Anderson Air Force Base in the Western Pacific on the island of Guam. And this has been the apparatus of U.S. power. And apart from the diplomacy, the economy, the global military presence, the covert operations, this geopolitical foundation for U.S. global power, most Americans have no idea that it existed, and they certainly have no idea. In fact, most people in Washington have no idea whatsoever how central it's been, because it's been around for 70 years. It's been 3 generations. Our grandparents built this thing. You know, our parents inherited, we inherited from them, and we have no idea what it is and how important it's been. And right now, it's starting to crumble under the Trump administration.
And you know, there's perhaps overspending, overextension. I mean, the being all over the world and having bases everywhere. There was the sea, which was the source of power, and now there's that new territory, the skies, the stars, as it were. The fear that we had of Sputnik back then, that the Russians were going to own that particular field of conflict, and I just wonder about spreading ourselves too thin and spending down our treasury. There's a lot to talk about here in this book. Fascinating book, and it looks very, it looks very clearly at what the factors are that is causing the decline. As you point out in 1979, quote, the revolution in Iran signaled loss of its keystone position in the Gulf, leaving Washington flailing about ever since to rebuild its geopolitical leverage in the region, end of quote. Placing the Iranian people's demand for independence from U.S.-installed governments in the context of the great game, the West versus the Soviet Union, led us back to the Mujahideen, as you mentioned, in Afghanistan. As you explained, the Brits had forts all along India's northwest frontier, so we had a proliferation of bases across Afghanistan and Iraq. In terms of the big picture, what was our goal, and more importantly, how has it turned out?
Well, first of all, the geopolitical forces driving that. As we know, in the 19th and early 20th century, the British played the great game against Russia.
Right.
And essentially, it was the British maintaining a series of forts along the northwest frontier of what's now Pakistan, India. Mm-hmm. They mounted between the 1850s through the 1890s, something like 40 military expeditions into Afghanistan, essentially trying to control that area as a buffer state with Russia. And why? Well, if you go back to Sir Halford Mackinder and his theory of the world island, He said that the epicenter of control for the walled island is what he called the pivot region. And it's really, you know, Soviet Central Asia and beyond. It's the heartland. It's the core of the continent. And what Britain was doing was contesting Russia, trying to push them back into that core and to keep them there. And Mackinder also said another pathway into that core, into that heartland, which is the epicenter of control, the pivot of control over this vast Eurasian landmass, is through the Persian Gulf across Iran that way. Okay, so it's sort of pathways into this area. In theory, if you take Mackinder, that's the deeper geopolitical driver beyond the conflict. Well, more immediately, what we've been trying to do is to establish another surrogate state like we had with Iran, which was kind of the guardian of the Gulf on the north flank of the Persian Gulf. And we tried to do that by intervening in Iraq, establish that massive green zone embassy and turn that into a client state, along with our base at Bahrain, our alliance with the Emirates, and similar microstates along the Persian Gulf would give us, you know, a new position in the southern side of the Persian Gulf. Of course, that hasn't worked out very well for us. It's been very troubled.
Yeah, what do you mean by that? More specifically, how has it not worked out? How has it affected our stability, basically, and global hegemony in that area?
Well, if you use a geopolitical model, what I argue is that if you sort of look at the Persian Gulf as an elaborate arch, once the Shah fell in Iran in 79, that removed the keystone of the arch and it collapsed. And we've been engaged in conflict around that rim ever since. In 79, we plunged into Afghanistan for a covert war that lasted a full decade, a little longer, actually from 1979 to 1992. And of course, we're back in Afghanistan again and we're expanding our troops. That's on the eastern side of that arch, that geopolitical arch. And again, we've during the 1980s, we backed Iraq in that disastrous war with Iran, and then we fought the Persian Gulf War in 1991, and then in 2003 we invaded Iraq. So we've been struggling to reestablish something akin to a position of geopolitical stability in the region like we had with the Shah of Iran.
Right.
And that we just have not succeeded in doing it. And so we have this ongoing series of operations. We have surrogate war. We have massive ongoing air campaign in northern Iraq. We have special forces and on the ground with the Iraqi army and with the Kurds. And we have 12,000 troops in Afghanistan and increasing. Under President Obama, we got up to a peak of 101,000 soldiers. So this is this ongoing struggle for geopolitical stability. And if you look for a deeper logic underlying it, it's this geopolitical logic of controlling this pathway into the pivot region, controlling the heart of Central Asia. And it's a geopolitical game, by the way, that in ways that we never expected, that we're beginning to lose. But when Sir Halford Mackinder propounded this grand thesis about the Eurasian landmass and the world island, the thing that provoked him was the first railroad that was being constructed from Moscow to Vladivostok across the 5,000 miles of Russia, the Trans-Siberian Railroad. And Mackinder predicted that rails would become an infrastructure that would span this continent and would shift the geopolitical balance from the maritime powers that controlled the arc around the Eurasian landmass for five centuries. And it would move the epicenter of power into the Eurasian landmass and unify it. Well, that didn't happen. More particularly for 40 years, the Cold War, the Sino-Soviet tension, that prevented that from happening. But what has happened now, and really in the last 10 years, is China has used its massive, a $4 trillion cash surplus from its global trade, much of it with the United States. And starting in 2007, thereabouts, they invested their first $1 trillion in a massive infrastructure program to realize, in a sense, Mackinder's vision to lace the Eurasian landmass with not just railroads, which they're doing, massive railroad construction, but also an incredibly ambitious network of pipelines that run from Siberia into northeast China, from Central Asia all the way into China, and then from Burma and the Andaman Sea all the way into southwestern China. And China is realizing Mackinder's vision. He said that when this happens, when the Eurasian landmass is finally unified economically, it will be the site for the rise of a new world empire. And that rising empire is China, and it's this geopolitical strategy that President Xi Jinping calls the Silk Road strategy or the One Belt One Road strategy. And China has announced in the conference recently, a major international conference, another $1 trillion investment in the infrastructure of this region. Again, roads, rails, pipelines. And they've complemented this with military bases. Those seven islands that they've transformed into military bastions in the South China Sea, that's straining our 7th Fleet to the absolute limit to maintain freedom of navigation.
Yeah.
They're building an integrated corridor from western China all the way down to the Arabian Sea. They transformed, at the cost of about $200 billion, a little fishing village at Gwador into now a modern port. And they have a port in East Africa near the mouth of the Red Sea. So China is, through these kinds of base constructions, is slicing through those circles of steel that the United States has laid around the Eurasian landmass.
Well,
so not only is the axial ends, our relationship with those four key Asian allies, the NATO alliance, not only is that weakened, but China is slicing through the linkages between those two axial ends, breaking up our encirclement of the Eurasian landmass.
I wanted to ask, you know, the long Cold War, it was pictured as a fight between us and them, America or the Soviets would be the leader of the world. And now I wonder, will either Russia or China replace the U.S. as the world superpower? Why or why not?
Yeah, first of all, we're talking about the future, right? And
after the decline is complete.
Right. I mean, when you're talking about the future, as an historian, I join a long lineage of historians that apply their knowledge of the past to predicting the future. And it's amazing, not only do historians usually get it wrong,
right,
comically so. So it's a risky enterprise that we're engaged in.
I understand, but...
Okay, but if you had to guess, China has the raw economic power. And if Mackinder is right, okay, how can I put it? Zygmunt Brzezinski, in the way he played geopolitics in Central Asia and liberated Eastern Europe, applying Mackinder to the practical matters of diplomacy, it seems to work. Okay, so if Mackinder's right, all right,
right. If he's right,
yeah, if he's right, then China's geopolitical move of building this massive infrastructure to link Eurasia and make it into a world island. And mind you, they also have massive investments in Africa as well. They're bringing in the third continent to really integrate the world island.
Yeah.
Then that will, and if NATO weakens, and as clearly as happening, our bilateral relationship with Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Australia, those are weakening very rapidly now. So if those axial ends that we've used to control the Eurasian landmass crumble, the encirclement, those circles of steel, of naval patrols and alliances and drone bases and air bases that we built around the Eurasian landmass at enormous expense over 70 years, if that all crumbles and this infrastructure goes through and China really can unify this vast 6,000-mile stretch that's the bulk of the Earth's non-watery surface, the bulk of the world's landed surface, then axiomatically, China will become this titanic power. Okay, so that's on the plus side for China. There's also a military challenge, and we can talk about that. can China win a war with the United States? Because oftentimes these imperial transitions are very violent.
Indeed.
Okay, we can talk about that. The other factor is, though, that China lacks, okay, the advantages that both Britain and the United States had. Indeed, Spain had, France had to a certain extent. First of all, it has a non-Roman script, so its language is going to be difficult. One of the key artifacts of British influence and American influence as well has been the rise of the global language.
Uh-huh.
We have enormous soft power. Britain in its day had the BBC, it had the English language, it had English literature. It also had sports. You know, if you think about modern competitive sports, cricket, rugby, tennis, soccer, these are not terribly popular in the United States, but these are among the world's great global sports.
Yes.
Well, the U.S. added to that basketball, baseball. These are our global sports that have been enormously successful. And then, just as Britain had the BBC, we have the Hollywood film industry, which gives us enormous influence around the world. Soft power, Professor Nye of Harvard calls this. So China doesn't have many of the artifacts of soft power. There's also the ideals.
Right.
Britain stood for the idea of imperialism. They didn't necessarily practice as stewardship.
Right.
They advocated the rule of law. When the countries they left behind, they left strong judiciaries, independent judiciaries. we've just seen that in Kenya, that's a British-style judiciary that just overturned the elections that Uhuru Kenyatta thought he won by 50-plus percent. The courts overturned that. That's never happened in Africa before. That's the British judiciary in action. They also left behind very strong Westminster-style parliaments that have been much more resilient than our style of presidential, congressional government that we've left behind. the United States, just as Britain left behind positive legacies, we've stood for human rights, women's rights, and the international rule of law, the resolution of disputes not by arms but by the international court systems. China doesn't stand for any of those things. So China is very weak in the, if you will, the ideological appeal of its empire or its world system, and it's very weak in the soft power department. But, you know, so you can weigh it up. So maybe China will just simply weaken the United States, and maybe we'll have a more multipolar world where China might emerge as kind of a first among equals, a primus inter pares. There's a number of possibilities, but the one thing that's pretty clear is that America's decline is ongoing, and a new world order, unlike the one we've been living in for the last 70 years, is now emerging.
Yes, it is, and I think, as you say, there's some... It's going to be hard, but there may be perhaps somewhat of a soft landing that, you know, a lot of the values that we as Americans have, just as you said with the British and their court system, you know, maybe that will continue. I mean, the world is never going to stop loving American rock and roll, that's for sure. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're speaking with author Alfred McCoy, historian. His new book, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Power. And throughout the decades since the Philippines War, also called the Spanish-American War, but Americans have never been entirely comfortable about our exercise of military power beyond our borders. There's a long history of opposition to that war, to World War I, and especially to Vietnam. Yet even Obama was not about to side with this anti-colonial, arguably more traditional American value. As you point out, he said in 2010, "I do not accept second place for the United States of America," end of quote. I get the sense there's massive power over our government by interests that insist on global domination. If global rule is not really a priority among average Americans, might there be some reason for optimism about our post-empire future?
Well, something as complex as we can call an imperial transition, the move from, say, Britain to the United States back in the 1950s, this can be either managed slowly over time, skillfully, so you maximize your advantages, you minimize the costs, and you avoid disastrous decisions. And this is where political leadership matters, because it can either be a slow, gradual transition in which you emerge and, you know, with some losses, but some gains in your institutions, your economy, your society has a chance to cope and adjust and adapt. Or you can have some wrenching, precipitous changes
right.
that leave everybody's head spinning, produce all kinds of tensions and dislocations. This is where political leadership is very important. And here I make an analogy between the United States today under the Trump administration and Great Britain back in the 1950s when it was making a similar tradition under the government of Prime Minister Anthony Eden. Now, in the mid-1950s, when Eden replaced Churchill and came in as Prime Minister, Britain's economy had full employment. It was skillfully managing its imperial recessional, avoiding an armed conflict, negotiating a transition that turned over political power to emerging nations in Malaya, India, and all the rest, generally avoiding bloody pacifications, and preserving British investment, British access to markets. So cutting the costs and retaining the advantage. And this was a transition which for the British aristocracy, the British upper class, was deeply traumatic at the time that it was taking place. Because that's another thing about these imperial transitions. When they're ongoing, and very few people are able to react rationally about them, they're wrenching emotionally. And people get very irrational. And Sir Anthony Eden responded to President Nasser's nationalization of the Suez Canal in 1955 by basically deceiving the United States, colluding with the French and the Israelis. They met in secret near Paris, and they planned this elaborate ruse where the Israeli army unleashed itself across the Sinai Peninsula, came within about 10 miles of the Suez Canal, and the British and French scooped together everything left they had of their army, hundreds of aircraft, six aircraft carriers, 300,000 soldiers, and they threw them into the Suez Canal zone. And they scored a momentary victory. The Israelis smashed the Egyptian army in the Sinai. British air power destroyed the Egyptian air force. Much of it fled to neutral countries to preserve itself. They, of course, completely mismanaged the diplomatic and economic aspects. Britain couldn't afford to do this anymore. They needed a $1 billion bailout from the International Monetary Fund. The first, actually, of all these bailouts that we've heard of since had to be done to save the British pound sterling, which was a global reserve currency, from basically losing massive value.
Mm-hmm.
And the world was suddenly on notice that the mighty British lion was now a toothless pet, Washington's tamed circus animal. And that was it. Now, the Trump administration is in a similar situation. There's no doubt by every indicator, and we can talk about them. The U.S. economic influence is waning. China, by 2030, will be the world's largest economy, if not earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The dollar is already under pressure as a global reserve currency. The Chinese currency is now part of the basket of currencies for the first time. We're in the midst of a long, slow imperial transition from unchallenged American hegemony. And along comes Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And he is almost with a kind of malign design, has divined the pillars of U.S. global power and begun attacking each one in turn. As I said earlier, you know, the key geopolitical basis of U.S. global power has been controlled over the axial ends of the Eurasian landmass through two key military arrangements. One, NATO. Well, when Trump went to NATO last spring, he refused to acknowledge the common defense position of NATO. He's damaged NATO enormously. The other axial end of our control over the Eurasian landmass is our relations with Korea, Japan, the Philippines, and Australia. Well, we've lost the Philippines already. They're gone. They're our oldest and closest international ally, virtue of colonization.
Mm.
They're gone. They're in China's ambit already.
Mm.
South Korea, Trump has challenged the free trade agreement. He's excoriated the president of South Korea for proposing to negotiate with the North.
Right.
And in Australia, an absolutely loyal ally, he insulted the Prime Minister of Australia and his Malcolm Turnbull in his sort of introductory phone call. And for the first time, we're getting close to 50% of the Australian people in polls, it's actually 45% and rising, believe that Australia should turn away from the United States yes. and ally with China.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah, it really is. And you have written that despite the aura of omnipotence empires often project, most are surprisingly fragile. And now we do have Trump. You write that the Trump White House weakened, as we've been saying, many of the key components in a delicately balanced system that had sustained Washington's preeminent position for 70 years, unwittingly accelerating the move toward a new world order. Sometimes I wonder, can it really be that unwittingly? Or is he, I mean, it's so clearly unraveling America's global strength. And I wonder, you know, perhaps it's too late for a new president, a more sensible president, you know, if he or she pulls back from, you know, all our hundreds of bases around the world and stop being so militaristic and get back on track toward, you know, what the world likes about America. I wonder if it's too late and how much has Trump really, as you say, unwittingly accelerated the move toward a new world order?
Well, he did one thing right away. First of all, he had under Steve Bannon, his sort of advisor extraordinaire, a hyper-nationalist, a kind of fortress America vision that we would cut our foreign ties, we'd get out of all these trade pacts, and that we would bring home jobs to America, Americans manufacturing goods for America, American military defending America, a very simplistic view that ignored the 70 years of the global world that the United States, more than any other single power, had built. And the one thing that Donald Trump did right away when he became president was he canceled the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Right.
Now, let's wind back, okay, to geopolitics. Under the Obama administration, and many people don't agree with me, I regard Barack Obama as one of three Americans in the last 120 years who you could brand a geopolitical genius. The first was Elihu Root, the former Secretary of War and Secretary of State. The other was the National Security Advisor to President Carter, Zbigniew Brzezinski. And the third was Barack Obama. Obama understood the nature of the Chinese challenge. He could see what the Chinese were doing with their One Belt, One Road strategy, unifying the Eurasian landmass through that $1 trillion infrastructure project. And what he came up with was two trade pacts, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would drain the eastern half, the trade, the commerce, the lifeblood of the continent across the Pacific towards the United States. And then there was another trade pact, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership with the European Union, that would drain the other half of the Eurasian landmass, lifeblood of commerce and trade towards the United States. Those two treaties, if they'd been implemented, would have directed 60%, over half of the world trade, preferentially to the United States. And China could build all the roads and rails and pipelines it wanted to, but the trade would be moving by sea towards America. And so that Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TTP, you know, was negotiated. You know, Secretary Hillary Clinton worked assiduously, flying all over the world to get that thing going. Obama backed it under both Secretary Clinton and Secretary John Kerry. They actually got an agreement. It was ready for being approved. Japan, which was very reluctant initially under Prime Minister Abe, became a full-throated advocate of the treaty. We had very strong support from our allies, and Trump just killed it. Well, that's not coming back. And what's going to be the result? Well, China has its own regional cooperation pact with 16 nations to replace that and direct that trade towards China.
Mm. Well, what the heck? It's their trade. It's their money. And trade really is everything. You know, I wonder, we've seen in challenging times leaders often appeal domestically to memories of past national greatness or myths about past national greatness. I'm really worried that we may see new displays of American power as we so desperately seek to regain lost prestige and power. And I'm sure you've heard the phrase, when you're in a hole, stop digging. But oftentimes, confused leaders dig faster and harder. I get the sense that maybe this is going on. What do you think?
Yeah, there's some clever historians have defined something called micromilitarism. And what this means is that when a great power or an empire is in decline, an empire that during its rise used its military rationally and skillfully to build that empire, that when it begins to slip away, that empire will have this idea that they can recover all of that fading glory, that power, by a bold military strike.
Right.
And there are lots of examples. Britain in 1955 under Anthony Eden, attacking Egypt, occupying the Suez Canal zone. That was micromilitarism par excellence. All right. And so there's a possibility that the United States would do something like that, launch a major military operation, a blow. In fact, you could make a case that we've already done it once, that the Iraq War in 2003 was supposed to be this bold geopolitical gambit that would stabilize the Persian Gulf region finally and insert the United States into that region in a firm bastion, the Green Zone, in Baghdad. And then from that, democracy would radiate across the region. Free market economies would prosper. These Arab semi-socialist states would crumble, and we'd have a region fully integrated into the American world system. It turned out to be, of course, a disaster that showed the limits of American power, just as Britain showed the limits of its power in Suez. But under President Trump, there's a possibility of yet another micromilitary operation.
Yeah.
It can come with a stretch thin all the way around the globe. It could come against the Russia in Eastern Europe. It could come in the Persian Gulf region. It could come somewhere in Asia against China, in the South China Sea. It could come in Korea. But there are all kinds of temptations for the use of military force.
Yeah, and it's so popular domestically. People, I don't know, not me, but a lot of people seem to like it. Question, do you see a connection between an empire's use of torture and its inevitable decline? Is there a connection?
Yes, yes. It's just as empires are rational, ruthless perhaps, but rational in their use of force when they're in the ascent. Their excesses, which can be extraordinarily harsh and cruel, oftentimes in a paradoxical way, seem to work. But then when they're winding down, just as they lash out militarily through these disastrous micromilitary interventions overseas, so they decide that similarly that setting aside their principles and the modern era legal restraint and engaging in torture is going to get them information. It's going to be display of raw force that will break the resistance that they're facing. The French Empire in Algeria in the 1950s, when it was faced with the massive nationalist uprising under the National Liberation Front, had the idea that they could torture their way into defeating the National Liberation Front. Indeed, it did work in the battle for the Kasbah, the battle for Algiers, that is shown vividly and accurately in that brilliant film by Peter Corville.
Yeah.
But it was counterproductive, because back in France, and it was reported in the French press, the French public recoiled that this was being done in their name. The French enterprise lost support internationally, and in many ways it accelerated the decline and the collapse of that attempt to hold on. The British did the same. They did it in Aden. They did it in Northern Ireland. It delegitimated them in both areas and created a huge national embarrassment for them.
And
for the British torture in Northern Ireland, the Attorney General had to appear before the European Human Rights Court and give a solemn undertaking that Her Majesty's government would never, ever use these kinds of methods again. You can make the case that in Iraq, the same thing. It was enormously counterproductive.
Terribly. It's all about hearts and minds. I mean, let's face it, to really rule the world, you have to have at least some degree of the hearts and minds of the people. And you call them the subordinate elites. What has been the long-term effect of our traditional cultivating of local chiefs in third world countries around the world? What kind of governments, with regard to our stated love of democracy, were actually created and supported by America? What was our goal there? And how well did it work? And what about these subordinate elites and the inevitable decline of U.S. global power?
Sure. No imperial system can rule by raw coercion. It requires the compliance, the active collaboration of the leaders of a society. No matter how great and powerful the empire, there simply aren't enough soldiers, there aren't enough war machines to rule by coercion. The Nazis tried this in Europe in World War II, and that empire imploded from within. But the British were very skillful. Wherever they went, they ruled over a quarter of humanity directly at their peak in 1900. And they worked very cleverly with Fiji Island chiefs, Malay sultans, Indian Maharajas, African emirs. And these were generally local elites in kind of county-size areas. And then above that would be a British colonial administration for Federated Malaya or the Fiji Islands or East Africa or wherever, or British India. And then when 100 nations, when 6 European maritime empires collapse after World War II and 100 new nations emerge, over half the nations that exist today, when these nations emerge, that meant that the locus of power shifted from the old colonial districts, the chief, the Maharaja, the Sultan, and moved up to the presidential palace. And under the Eisenhower administration, the CIA became the instrument for monitoring the political loyalties and effecting regime change when necessary in our side of the Iron Curtain. We failed in our attempts to penetrate the Soviet and Chinese side of the Iron Curtain, so we turned our covert apparatus to using this as a way of resolving a fundamental contradiction. Look, in the post-World War II period, when you have a series of sovereign nations, intervention in a foreign country is ipso facto illegal. So how do you intervene when you can intervene? How can you have exercise global hegemony when there's not supposed to be hegemony? The answer was, of course, covertly.
Uh-huh.
And so we manipulated elections, we sponsored coups. Between the late 1950s and early 1970s, about a quarter of the sovereign nations on the planet changed governments via coup. The CIA was behind many of them.
And it doesn't work for the long term, right? I mean, people recognize that. It's been so counterproductive. I hope we're not still doing that. I have no idea.
No, we've tried it recently. We tried it in 2002 in Venezuela, and it backfired.
True.
And we tried electoral manipulation recently. We tried it in 2009 in the Iran elections. Backfired. Didn't work. The failures are a sign of our waning global power. Yeah, one of the key manifestations of this was that about 11% of the elections in the world were manipulated either by the Soviet Union or the United States during the Cold War. And we did about 80% of the manipulation. In other words, we were manipulating other people's elections. For example, we started this in 1948. We intervened in the side of the Christian Democrats to keep the socialists and communists out of power. For $1 million, we got a government in Italy. It was a real bargain buying. Italy for $1 million. I mean, that's an amazing deal. Well, what's changed now is in the 2016 elections, whose elections got manipulated? Our elections did. And that's a shift. When you're the global hegemon, you manipulate other people's elections. Your elections don't get manipulated.
Well, things have changed, haven't they? Well, the book is In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. How ready are Americans for this inevitable decline. What must we do to create a soft landing for America? Is it possible to, as you talk about, create to see a more transnational organization through shared governance of global commons with multilateral governance, free trade, human rights, and respect for sovereignty? How realistic is this vision?
You know, in the abstract, I think that is what's required. Is that a political reality? Hopefully, yes, but this transition, as we've seen in the last elections and what's going on in the United States, is very painful because, of course, globalization has its costs. And both parties, which signed up for globalization, yeah, were insensitive to the kind of impact it was having on sectors of American society, both the working class and given regions in the country that were being hollowed out. And there was a political reaction. Well, you know, we could have managed that better. So it's going to require, I mean, above all, we have to understand the world system in which we're operating. If we're going to manage this system, if we're going to have a slow, less painful transition, right, it's going to take understanding, informed debate, and discussion. So we identify what our key interests are, and then manage so that we maximize the benefits of the transition and minimize the cost. Right now, we're not doing that very well at all. Maybe the Trump administration will be kind of an experiment in raw, unalloyed nationalism, fortress America approach. It's not working very well, and maybe there will be a national awareness that, no, this doesn't work. In fact, we have to manage this global system. We have to manage our relationship with the world, and we can begin to check and correct. That's something the future will tell.
Yeah, it certainly does seem to be accelerating the decline rather quickly, and maybe it'll be so clear that Americans will get it. And, you know, I think American influence in the world, again, has always been our culture, our stated, anyway, love for democracy and the system of justice. So, you know, I just hope it doesn't happen too quickly and, you know, that we can't handle it at all. I think this is quite the wake-up call. Trump is certainly accelerating it. Fascinating book. Very interesting. If you have any interest in history and in the future, for that matter, the book is In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. Alfred McCoy, thank you so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Thank you, Bert. Drift.